Blog Talk Radio.
So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Andelman, and this is the Mr. Media Interview, sponsored by the audiobook edition of Will Eisner, A Spirited Life, now available on iTunes and Audible.com, and recorded live on blogtalkradio.com from the new media and the oh-so-briefly American League Baseball capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. There are plenty of creative people whose work I worship, but you'll never catch me pursuing an interview with them. Bruce Springsteen, for one. I like the idea of leaving a little mystery out there, a little bubble I'll never personally pop. Nevin Martell, on the other hand, had a different idea. He is a devout fan of the old comic strip Calvin and Hobbes, created by Bill Watterson. And who isn't? It's one of the most brilliant dailies ever created, and when Watterson decided to suddenly stop producing it in 1995 after 10 years and 3,160 strips, no one was more disappointed than I. Okay, maybe Martell was. Only a complete edition of the published strips wasn't enough. He wanted to know more about Watterson, talk with him and the people who knew and admired him, and write a book about what made the man fly as high as Spaceman Spiff. Watterson, however, had other ideas. The last time he made a public appearance was 1990, and he had no interest in returning to the glare of the public spotlight or helping Martell analyze his work product. But Martell, unbowed, wrote his book anyway, looking for Calvin and Hobbes, the unconventional story of Bill Watterson and his revolutionary comic strip, was published this month, and tomorrow, October 17, 2009, he'll be signing books in Chagrin Falls, Ohio, at Fireside Books in the afternoon and the Cuyahoga County Public Library in the evening. Why Chagrin Falls? I'm sure he'll tell us. Nevin, welcome to Mr. Media.
Hey, thanks so much, Bob. Or do you prefer to be called Mr. Media?
You can call me whatever you like.
All right, Bob. Well, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. So, why Chagrin Falls? I think I know the answer. But
Chagrin Falls is not the town in which Bill Watterson was born. That was Watterson, D.C., but it was the town in which he grew up in, and it's a town that, in the book, I make a journey to find out more about his life and where he got his start as a cartoonist. And so it just seemed fitting that I would return there to see some of the people that I interviewed and do a signing in the bookstore, where, in fact, Watterson, even after he had retired, used to secretly stock autographed copies of his book. And so it all just seemed to make sense, and so that's why I'm heading out there.
No concerns about being met with people with pitchforks and, you know, flaming and flaming weapons?
No, you know, actually, I think I'm looking forward to hopefully a far different reception. I had the great pleasure and luck to interview some childhood friends of Watterson's, as well as his mother, all of whom still live in Chagrin Falls. And I've spoken to these people since the book's been released and since they've read copies of it, and they all really enjoyed it and felt that I treated their son and their friend with respect and with depth and with warmth. And so I'm looking forward to, you know, reconnecting with those people. And in fact, I had only interviewed his mother over the phone, and so if I have a chance to meet her this weekend, it'll be the first time I've met her in person, so that'll be really nice. You know, if there are people with, you know, tougher questions in the audience, I'm absolutely ready for them too, though.
Now, does Bill still live in Chagrin Falls?
He does not. He does not live in Chagrin Falls anymore.
So we're not expecting he will magically appear tomorrow.
We're not. If he does, I'm very much looking forward to the conversation, though.
So now that the book is done, did you find what you were looking for?
You know, it's interesting. When I went in to write the book, I had pitched it as a very straightforward biography, tracing the life and the times and the work of Bill Watterson. And what, in fact, it ended up turning out to be was a far more kind of personal journey, both for myself and hopefully for the reader, that traces my discovery of his life and my desire to get a personal interview with him, which, as you revealed in the intro, did not happen. But
right.
the book, I think, and the journey itself turned out to be very rewarding, certainly for me, and from what I'm hearing from people, for readers too.
Well, I thought, you know, we could hold out over people's head. Did he get the interview or not? But I thought, well, you know, it's not fiction. I guess we can let them in on the fact that it didn't happen.
Absolutely.
Did you ever feel that it was close to happening, that it might happen?
Well, I'm a very, very hopeful person, and despite the fact that my wife would say that I'm given to pessimism at times, which I certainly am, I went into the project, you know, wide-eyed and hopeful that something would happen and that maybe he would break his silence. As the book went on, it took me about 15 months to write. I have a full-time job, and so this was, you know, something that was kind of consuming the rest of my life. As I went on and just like the project started to overwhelm me just in terms of the amount of work, I became less hopeful until the very end, at which point the editor, Lee Salem, who had been Watterson's editor for years, kind of dangled the offer of asking Bill himself on my behalf. And at that point, I really did kind of perk up because I was like, well, if it's going to happen, this will be it. And it didn't end up happening, obviously. But, you know, I know that at least I made a connection, and even if the connection was turned away, I don't feel like I'm in bad company. There's been any number of other people who have tried to track him down over the years. And like I said, I think that the journey that I took, a lot of people, though, that have kind of just been rejected for an interview don't do anything. And I had this huge biography on him that I was doing anyway. And I've, you know, realized at that point that the story of trying to find Bill Watterson was, you know, part of that biography. And so in a way, it turned into an interesting narrative device for me, and so I don't regret it at all.
Now, you have a cautionary tale from Washington Post writer and columnist Gene Weingarten that I guess happened early in this process. Do you mind sharing that story?
Not at all. It was interesting because I didn't know that he had tried to track down Watterson himself. I was calling him because over the course of my research, at the end of every interview with a cartoonist or a comic historian, I'd say, oh, you know, is there anyone else that you think I should talk to that might have some interesting perspective on Watterson's work or life or maybe has interacted with him? Somebody recommended that I call Gene, and I called him up, and he said, you know, how did you know that I tried to track down Watterson myself? And I said, you should tell me that story because that sounds very interesting. And so he recounted the story where he flew out to Chagrin Falls, and he brought with him an original collection of Barnaby cartoons, which he was kind of hoping would sweeten the deal or, you know, show that Watterson, that he knew what he was talking about and that they were on the same page, and dropped it off along with a note with Watterson's parents, and proceeded to check himself into a hotel room and, you know, had said in the note, you know, I'm staying in this hotel room pretty much forever because I'm on Washington Post's expense account, and I don't think that's going to run out anytime soon. But the next morning, lo and behold, we get a phone call from Lee Salem, Watterson's editor, who said, you know, it's not going to happen. You can stay in the hotel room as long as you like, but you're going to be in there alone. So he ended up coming home empty-handed, didn't even write about it. And so it was just by chance that I uncovered this story about him, which was just one of the many fascinating little sidebars I didn't expect over the course of this project.
Well, I have a theory. After reading that story, I have a theory as to why Lee called him instead of just leaving him out there. I know Lee. I think Lee's a great guy. He's been a great supporter of mine over the years. But
absolutely.
I think that Lee called him and told him to give up because the Washington Post was a big client, and he didn't want to spend and piss away too much of their money, and then have them decide, you know, maybe we don't need to carry some of these new strips of yours.
I'm sure he was motivated in part by his good business sense, which he's you know, demonstrating any number of times over the years. Yeah.
I want to give out our phone number. There's a number of people. There's a live chat room that accompanies all the Mr. Media interviews. So I know that there's people listening to us today. If you'd like to call in and talk to Nevin Martell about his new book, Looking for Calvin and Hobbes, you're more than welcome. We'll be here for the next 20 minutes. 646-595-3135. If you get online, just be patient because I will not interrupt Nevin in the middle of an answer, but I will get to you as quickly as I can. So 646-595-3135. Give us a call if you'd like to talk to Nevin. So, Nevin, I'm from Mars, which is true, by the way, but You know, not the same Mars that Dr. Manhattan went to in Watchmen, but I'm from Mars, and I'd like you to explain to me the appeal of Calvin and Hobbes.
Well, I think the long-lasting appeal of Calvin and Hobbes is based in the fact that it really reminds you of what it was like to be a kid. Certainly as a guy, I can't speak for women because, you know, the strip is pretty male-centric, and though there are female characters like his neighbor Susie Durkins and his mother, looking at the strip, I really connected with it and still connect with it because I knew that experience as a kid. Like, I think every child, at least I hope every child, has that imaginative life that they go to, whether it's to escape or just to kind of revel in the wonder that's around them. And Calvin and Hobbes really illustrates that kind of interaction. And I always loved that because, you know, I was the kid in the backyard digging for dinosaur bones, and when I found, like, the old Coke can, I was like, oh, my God, I found a time capsule from another civilization. It's amazing. And, you know, that was something so cool. It didn't matter that it was a Coke can. And that, I think, is one of the great appeals of the strip, and also the fact that he's the kid that you wish you were, in the sense that, you know, he's just smart enough, but he's really a smart aleck. He's not an intellectual. You know, he's just athletic enough, but he doesn't play sports. He plays Calvin ball. You know, he's just mischievous enough in the sense that he likes to wallop his neighbor in the back of the head with a slush ball, but he's not out graffitiing the neighborhood. You know, he's just shy of, like, all the bad things you could be as a kid. Not that being an intellectual as a kid is bad, but, you know, he's not like a snobby intellectual kid. He's just a wise ass. And I think that's all so great. And I think the one thing that anybody, regardless of their sex, can kind of identify with is the fact that he has a best friend to do all of these things with, or to bounce all of these ideas off. And when you're a little kid, who wouldn't want a best friend to always be there to share in the adventures, to share in the sorrows, and to share in, you know, some of those great philosophical debates which Watterson had, you know, kind of played out in his strip so well, whether it's, you know, the meaning of life or why adults are so stupid or, you know, what happens when you die. And I think all those things add up to just something that's truly unforgettable. And because it was kind of based in this kind of place which had no real grounding, it really seemed timeless. And if you go back and look at the strips, I don't think you can say, oh, these are definitely from the mid-1980s, you know, or these are from the early 1990s. You could look at those strips and say that kid could have existed any time, you know, in the 20th century and beyond. And so I think that's a great part of the appeal as well.
Would the strip have been as appealing to as many people if there wasn't Hobbes along for the ride?
Absolutely not, because I think that gave Watterson his really unique narrative device, in the sense that there was a lot of strips where there were best friends undergoing adventures, and there were other strips where there was somebody pursuing their imaginative life, but there was no strip in which the imaginative life was overlaid the real world in such a deft and colorful way. And Hobbes was, you know, the outcome of that device. I really don't think that the strip would have been the same if it was just a kid with a real tiger or a kid with an actual doll that went on these adventures. I think it really only works the way Watterson had it, and I think that was part of its appeal. So I don't think it would work otherwise.
By the way, I want to go back a minute. When you told me about digging up the backyard and finding, you know, a buried Coke can, mm-hmm. were you excited to find that Coke was as old as the dinosaurs?
I was amazed. And, you know, I was about to rush out and tell the world that I had made this amazing discovery. Luckily, my mother, you know, stopped me short of, like, running down the street holding a dirty Coke can. But, you know, that didn't make the discovery and the experience of it any less wonderful. So,
So let me ask you this, based on what you were just saying. Is Watterson a genius, or is he just a guy who struck a chord with a lot of young men?
You know, I think that he is a genius, because oftentimes we look at things and we say, God, you know, really the idea of Hobbes is so simple. You know, Calvin sees him as a living, breathing tiger, and the rest of the world sees him as a doll. And that is a pretty simple storytelling device. And yet, Waterston used it in literally thousands of different ways and used the relationship between those characters to talk about some really interesting subjects. I mean, he touched on everything from environmentalism to, you know, the modern art movement to the commoditization, and there's a word that I just kind of messed up, of art. You know, the strip really allowed Waterston to play out a lot of his own inner turmoils. And the question that he got a lot, that, you know, I thought about a fair amount, was people wanted to know if when he was growing up he was Calvin. And the answer was definitely not. Like, he wasn't a rambunctious kid. Like, you know, he didn't get in a lot of trouble. He enjoyed school. He had lots of friends. He didn't have an imaginary friend. But Waterston was Calvin, pardon me, Calvin was Waterston as a grown-up, and Waterston used Calvin as a way for him to talk about things, and a perfect example of that is when he was going through kind of the turmoil with his syndicate trying to get back the rights to his strip into his characters so they wouldn't be merchandised and licensed. He used Calvin as basically a soapbox to discuss that, and Hobbes was the sounding board for those arguments. And I think that's really genius. I mean, you often see artist struggles play out in their work. But Waterston did it in a really clever way that never made you think that that was happening. It wasn't like Dawson's Creek, where Dawson like would start having these like conversations like a 45-year-old guy in a midlife crisis would be having, and you're, God, the show is being so obvious. Calvin did it really deftly, so it always felt natural to his world and to his perspective, and I think that's true genius. And plus, let's not forget, the artwork that accompanied all of these great conversations and all this great writing was phenomenal. And you know, it takes a lot to be phenomenal on the comics page. It's a limited palette of colors, and it's a very small space, and Waterston used it incredibly well.
Now, as you got into this, did you ever feel at times, you know what, I didn't really want to know this. I mean, it's taking away from my enjoyment of the strip.
You know, it's interesting because certain people who have read the book told me that by the end of it, they respected Waterston more because of the incredible pressure that he stood up against and won against in terms of getting the ownership of his strip and his characters back. And others have read it and said, you know what, he's kind of bitter, and he comes across as kind of angry sometimes, and it kind of destroyed the wonderful image that I had of him. And I wrote the book purposely in a way to kind of to be as objective as possible about the struggles that he went through as an artist, because I want people to draw their own conclusions. But I have to say, at times, I was incredibly warmed by the man that I didn't know that he was, in the sense that he mentored a lot of cartoonists that I didn't know. He had kind of played a role in everyone from Jeff Smith, who did Bone, to Michael Jansey, who did The Norm, had received guidance from Waterston over the years, and that was something I didn't know. And I felt that that was like a warm side to him that I didn't know, because he had kind of not involved himself in any of the professional cartooning organizations. But then, you know, there'd be other times when, you know, he was offered the opportunity to speak to Steven Spielberg about making an animated film, and he just didn't take the call and got really angry for being even told that there was a call on the line with Steven Spielberg. And then I'd root for him less, because my thought was, dude, you know, you're an awesome artist yourself, and, you know, you have a really interesting perspective on the world. Steven Spielberg, whether you like his movies or not, is a good artist at what he does, and has, certainly brings a unique perspective to his work. And wouldn't it just be interesting to hear what he had to say, even if at the end of the call you say, Steve, you know, I really appreciate the phone call, but frankly, I'm just kind of uniformly opposed to the concept of making a Calvin and Hobbes movie. Thanks, but no thanks. But at least you get to have that intellectual moment with a peer. And I thought it was kind of short-sighted or maybe obtuse of him not to take some of those opportunities. And I'm not saying he should have done the film or anything. I just think to have the conversations about them might have been interesting for him as a way to explore his own feelings about them, if nothing else.
So, based on what you learned, why do you think he retired so young? Was he tired of fighting with the syndicate? Was he tired of the aggravation over people wanting to, you know, make money on Calvin and Hobbes in other ways than what he intended? Or was he just, you know, kind of an unusual guy who wanted to go do his own thing?
I think it's a combination of those factors. Certainly, by the end of the strip, by the time he had kind of gotten ownership back of his work, that took a lot out of him. And he was not a guy who particularly enjoyed confrontation, from everything I was told. And so that had to be incredibly grueling for him. And I think also that a number of people mentioned that he felt that by the end of it, despite the fact that he took 2 9-month sabbaticals, which was really unheard of and is still unheard of in the cartooning community, he felt that the script and the characters were getting a little stale for him, and he was working too hard to come up with material that he felt wasn't as good as it was or could have been. And so I think that also kind of brought the retirement about. And, you know, I don't know if this played a role in it, but let's not forget that he was a millionaire at that point, and he really didn't have to do it. And I don't think that he was lazy and just gave it up because he was like, hey, I got my paycheck, I can check out now. But, you know, there was that massive safety net beneath him where he could say, you know, I don't ever want to do this again, and I'm going to be getting residual checks, as are my grandchildren's grandchildren. And, yeah, I'm going to go paint and be a husband and be a father and ride bikes and learn how to play music, and that's what I'm going to do because, you know, frankly, no one needs to tell me what else I can do.
Is he a husband and a father?
He is. He married his high school sweetheart, and they adopted a little baby girl named Violet.
Oh, so very nice.
He is both.
And it's very interesting to me that his mother agreed to speak with you, although he didn't. How did that go?
It went very well, and it came at the very, very end of the process of writing the book, pretty much when I was at my wit's end as well, because I was worried that I didn't have an ending suitable to the project, because at that point I had already embarked on making the book a journey, because I was pretty sure about, you know, 3/4 of the way through that I wasn't going to talk to Watterson. And then I get to the end, and I'm like, wow, well, I could either rewrite the whole book, or I could, you know, there has to be something to summate all of this. And Mrs. Watterson had spoken to some people that I had already spoken with, and she had felt that the way I conducted myself with them and that my intentions were good. And so she agreed to talk to me, and it turned into a really lovely conversation. She's a really warm woman, and she and her husband have a different view about, you know, celebrating their son's work than their son does, in the sense that they're willing to talk about it, even if he isn't. And it, you know, I ended up speaking to her and, you know, really, I think, getting a much deeper sense of their son than I ever would have had if that conversation wouldn't have happened, certainly. And I think it provided a nice kind of ending to the story of the journey as well.
It probably, you probably learned things from her that you would never have gotten from him, even if he had been cooperative, just because of the, I mean, I know from doing this kind of work that the nature of people is that they can only give you so much of their world, and sometimes you have to have that 360-degree view of other people looking in and telling you things and filling in gaps. So
absolutely. She definitely did. And it was nice to hear it from her, and I've since heard from her, like I said, I think at the beginning of the call, that, you know, she has read the book and enjoyed it, and she felt that it, you know, did a great service to her son's life and work. And so, you know, talk about 360, I was really happy that it kind of came back to a happy conclusion for her as well.
So you didn't get to talk to Bill, but, you know, if you could ask him any 3 questions that are still on your mind, what would they be?
Oh, God, Bob, 3 questions, that's like three wishes for the genie. It's like, can the first wish be that I get, you know, unlimited
3 more wishes? Yeah. No. No.
You know, I think one of the questions that I'd certainly ask him, I can't speak to all 3, but I think one of them would be, over the course of all the conversations that I had, especially with the cartoonists who kind of knew him or had interacted with him, you know, they all say that at the end of his tenure working on Calvin and Hobbes, he stopped communicating with all of them. You know, this includes, you know, like Lynn Johnston, who does For Better or For Worse, and he kind of fell out of touch with Jim Borgman, who now does Zits. And he put all of the work that he had been given by all these cartoonists over the years also on deposit at Ohio State University as well as, you know, his own archives. Mm-hmm. And I would just want to ask him, you know, like how he could turn his back, not just on cartooning, because I can understand if you feel like you want to move on to something else artistically, but how could you turn your back on like that whole part of your life, you know, the art, the people, everything. I think that would be so hard to do, and I wonder if he ever regrets any part of that, and whether he ever sees a time in his life where he might want to embrace the considerable amount of love that exists for him in the cartooning community as well as in other artistic communities. So,
I'd like to answer that question on behalf of Bill.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
No. Go on. What's the next question?
That would be when I was like, oh, God, this is going to be a tough interview, isn't it? Okay. It's going to be the old yes-no, yes-yes-no-no no routine. Great.
Yeah.
But that's a no from Bill Watterson, darn it.
That's a no. That is a no from Bill Watterson. Who gave you the most insight into him besides his mom?
I would say the two other interviews that were incredibly helpful in shaping my understanding of him and his life were the several interviews I did with Lee Salem, his editor, and the interviews that I did with Rich West, who was a friend of his from college that has remained in touch with him over the years and is a comic historian himself. You know, those two men were able to kind of guide me through parts of his career that hadn't really been illuminated before. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they gave me some really interesting insights to different junctures in Watterson's life. And actually, a couple of other people that were interesting were the two editors that he worked with. Well, the two executives that he worked with at United, who was the syndicate that had him when he developed Calvin and Hobbes and then let him go. And that was interesting because they talked about, you know, the development of the strip early on and why it wasn't picked up by United and how they had actually offered for him to do another strip called Robot Man, which Jim Medick ultimately took up. And that was an interesting part of his life that, again, hadn't really been illuminated before. So they were very helpful in kind of bringing that part of his life to life.
My suspicion is that Lee Salem, the Universal mm-hmm. Press Syndicate managing editor, president now, that he probably was rooting for you to get the interview because there's probably a few questions he'd like to get answered.
I think so, and also on kind of a mercenary level, I don't think it would hurt the residual sales of Calvin and Hobbes collections to have a book like mine out in the market. Just like I think the very fact that it's out there in the market now, I think it, you know, it brings people back to Calvin and Hobbes that might have forgotten about it or who wouldn't, you know, walk into the bookstore and buy a Calvin and Hobbes book just any old day. So I think that, you know, he would see it as a way for maybe to promote Calvin and Hobbes without Bill having to come out of retirement.
Well, Nevin, I have just one more question for you before we let you go. Whose privacy will you seek to invade and disrupt next?
Well, I'm gonna do a doubleheader on Gary Larson and Thomas Pynchon. I'm just kidding.
Oh man.
You know, I don't know what my next project is. I'm considering.
I'm sorry. Excuse me. I'm sorry. What? We've got a call. Oh, it's Gary Larson's attorney on line two. Do you want to take this call? Go ahead.
Absolutely. No, I really have no idea what I'm doing next. I think it might be a collection of short stories about my own youth, but that really remains to be seen.
All right. Well, folks, you can find Nevin Martell's new book, Looking for Calvin and Hobbes, The Unconventional Story of Bill Watterson and His Revolutionary Comic Strip, in great bookstores and probably a few comic book stores everywhere, or you can order it online at mrmedia.com, mrmedia.com. You can also see Nevin on tour in October. Check his blog. Check his Facebook page, his fan page, for more detail. He's also on Twitter at twitter.com/looking4Calvin, looking for Calvin. And Nevin, thanks so much for joining us on Mr. Media today.
Thank you, Bob. It's been really fun. I had a great time.
My pleasure. Good luck. Hopefully he'll show up soon. And folks, for interviews with your other favorite daily comic strip artists, you can surf over to our main website, www.mrmedia.com. That's where you can listen to my earlier conversations with Mort Walker, Stefan Pastis, Ray Billingsley, Mort Walker, Jim Borgman, and many more. Please think about writing an online review of Mr. Media, casting a vote for Mr. Media, or marking Mr. Media as one of your favorites. Whether you listen on Blog Talk Radio, blogcritics.org, TrueSlant, Pointer Online, Digital Journal, Vox, Mediafly, Podfeed.net, Blueberry, Zencast, Zimbio, Current, or Odeo. And subscribe to Mr. Media on iTunes and you'll never miss a show. Just search Mr. Media Interviews from within iTunes and subscribe for free. Or subscribe to Mr. Media's blog on the Amazon Kindle Reader. You can also listen with a piece of string and a tin can in many locations. If you've got an idea for a guest, email me directly at bob@andelman.com. That's A-N-D-E-L-M-A-N. You can also follow me on Facebook or on Twitter, www.twitter.com/andelman or www.facebook.com/andelman. Thanks so much for joining us today. Always appreciate when you share a piece of your day with Mr. Media. Thanks for listening, everybody.